And now, welcome to The Approach with Jeremy Seaholm, Danny Finn.
Welcome to the show. We're glad to finally have you.
I mean, I'm on after Amanda, but I mean,
we did ask you first. I think it was just a matter of getting everything scheduled out on our end.
All right, that works for me. I feel better.
You were asked first.
No, I mean, it's been absolutely hectic, at least on our end, too. I mean, Danny's been working 6-7 days a week on top of his full-time job, family things. And it's tough.
It is. And that's why we went. That's why we went down to every other week with the podcast is it's just this is supposed to be my slow time. And I'm working 55, almost 60 hours a week right now. And this is my slow time. So
only ramps up from here.
It does. And I'm not, 25, 30 years old anymore. So
one of the issues we have is Jeremy's busy time is when I have our slow time. So we're going to cross over on we were never going to be slow at the same time.
Yeah. I get it. It's tough, but it's still fun. So we'll go from there. And
yeah, it was a lot easier when I worked here because I could just set a day. I'm like, oh, I'm here this and this day. Let's just do it. Like it was fun. Yeah.
He didn't think this through when he bailed on us.
They still say
it, Jeremy.
Yeah. Did not think of the team. Not think of the team. So getting into early on your career, were you in a youth league as a bowler when you were a kid?
I was.
When did you start?
I was 6 months. Well, I was actually 3 months old when my mother started bringing me to the bowling alley. Didn't bowl at 3 months, but so I started league at 3 years old. I think I was three.
Yeah.
When I started the kids league.
And I think you said on the podcast that on your podcast, which we're going to talk about more later as well, you never felt like you were forced to bowl. It was something you just enjoyed doing.
Yeah. I my mother brought me down and that's all I knew. You know, yeah. I played other sports, but
what other sports?
Oh God. I played them all. Baseball, basketball, football, golf. I mean, I've been golfing since I was eight. Been skiing since
golf,
I was
golf bowler crossovers I've noticed.
Yeah, well it's I don't know why, but apparently we really like to hate ourselves. So we bowl and then we golf.
My old boss, Helen, she always said that if you were a good kid up in bowler, you were usually a pretty good golfer. Because the timing is almost, the same.
Yeah, I mean I played a lot when I was younger. I was the captain of our golf team in high school, my senior year. And I played as the best I ever got was a year or two out of high school. I got down to about a 3.5 handicap and, was like, hey, I'm going to go to college and play, at a school. And I was going to go to Merrimack. And at the time they were Division II. And I ended up not going and kind of golf petered out from there. But I will go out and shoot somewhere between 77 and 85. Very rarely is it above 85. Very rarely is it below 77.
If I shoot 93, I leave very happy. if I could keep it under 100, I'm usually pretty good. But I don't play that much. That's okay.
Well, and I'm not as competitive anymore as I used to be because I don't know. I have more fun just going out and hitting the ball and enjoying the fact that it's, 75 degrees and sunny and, than actually taking it really competitive. So I don't really care all that much when I play anymore. I just go and hit the ball. I don't get mad when it goes in the woods.
Look for the
card.
You said your mother brought you down, so she was a bowler?
Yeah, my mom bowled. My dad bowled the league, but he quit early on. My mom was on the main pro tour. She was a state champion. She won a couple of pro tour stops, got a couple of lane records. My sister and I took to it. My brother bowled a little bit, and then he went off to college. My mom was pretty big into it. And
do you have any of those trophies or any pictures of those trophies?
I don't actually. I get rid of all my trophies. I've got a few, you know, still left that I haven't got rid of. But I had no room, and you know, my mother didn't want them, and I was like, it's there. I mean, I honestly, I couldn't tell you. I was not a good junior bowler. I'll put that right out front. I was not a good junior bowler. I bowled junior league, and then we bowled the state tournaments, and that was it. And I might have had a 100, 105 average up until I was 17-ish. And then Russ Neely bought the bowling alley and fixed it up and took me under his wing and said, you could actually do something with this game. And within 3 years, I was up to 120. So
how often did you practice?
From the time I was 17, I also worked at the bowling alley every once in a while. Russ would have me come down and work. So especially in the summer, he's like, you might get three people all day. So open it up at 10 and close it at 10. And so I'd be there for 12 hours. I'd get four people and I'd bowl for 8 hours. Like, just, I'm the only one there. What else am I going to do?
Yeah.
You know,
and you're young, so you can actually do that for 8 hours, where now I can bowl for 2 hours and
right.
I feel like I got hit by a car.
You know, there was a period, I guess, from the time I was 17 to 22. So a 5 year period where I only bowled one or two nights a week, like in league, but I was down there. I bet 4 or 5 times a week because Russ had pulled me aside and said, look, you've got potential. Anytime you want to come down and bowl, you bowl against me, it's free. Well, you tell me free bowling and, you know. So I probably bowled on average 30 strings a week for 4 or 5 years. And then, of course, tournaments and whatnot. So once I started working, truly working, and, you know, ended up with a family and all that stuff. I've only bowled one night a week for the last 28 years.
So how did that relationship start between you and Russ as far as him taking you under his wing?
He bought the bowling alley. The biggest thing is he bought the bowling alley. And
were you a junior league bowler at the time, or was it through your mom?
I was either a junior or senior in high school. So it was my last year or two of juniors. And I had gone down and there was this kid bowling. And I was like, who the hell is this kid? I've never seen him before. And it was Nate. And I was like, oh, okay. So that's how I met Russ and Nate and everyone else was, I didn't even know the bowling alley sold. So I started going to my mother's tournament. So like the Pro Tour, I would go with her and I'd bring my bowling balls. And if they needed a pacer, I'd bowl. So I'd bowl for free. And Russ kind of saw me and I'd, you know, he just saw that I was putting the effort in. And, you know, I might have had a little bit of a, might have been a little bit of a mental head case back then.
Really?
Yeah, I know it's really hard to, I know it's really hard to believe. You know, but, the one thing Russ never did was he never tried to change my style of bowling. Never once tried to change it. He might have tweaked it here and there.
Yeah.
Try an extra step here, try something a little bit different. But he never tried to change the way I threw the ball. What he did was he focused more on my the mental side of the game. My attitude. I mean, it took me a long time to learn the lessons. But, it was more of that. And just learning how to practice.
Yeah.
It's not just going down and throwing 3 to 5 strings and saying, hey, keep score and be done. It was, no, don't keep score. You know, for this string, I just want you to hit the head pin, press the button, hit the head pin, press the button. Okay, now I want you to hit the 2 pin, press the button. You know, it was working a progression. Then throw a string of just object pins. Don't worry if you make the shot, just object. So that's kind of how I went from that 100, 105 up to a 118 to 120. And then once I got up there, then it was the mental side, the mental hurdle to get over the 120 and get up to that, 125 and higher. So
What was the highest you averaged?
130. You know what's funny is Athern can tell you. He's like Rain Man when it comes to stats, and like with my stats, it's like 133 point something
for an entire season.
For an entire season.
Wow.
There was a kind of a 5 to 8 year stretch where I was anywhere from a 128, 129 to a 133, almost a 134. That was just that league.
That still blows my mind. Just because when you're averaging 134 a string, and if you're not, you know, Tommy Olsta, I mean, was it Atkins they said he averaged 141 or something like that?
God, it was, I want to say it was Atkins that did that. And it just, I can't fathom averaging 140 for an entire year. I can't.
No, that seems absurd. You mentioned the main pro tour. Now, like at that point, how many, when you started on it, how many guys were on the tour?
We had, my first year was 90 something men, almost 100 men, and 30 to 40 women.
So decent size.
Oh yeah. And that was just main bowlers. That wasn't like the Mass Pro Tour, which had, you know, Mass, New Hampshire, Charlie and Russ and AJ from Maine going down and bowling. This was just main bowlers. By the time I got done with the main pro tour, they were down to like 20 to 25 men and like 8 to 10 women.
Was that due to like alleys closing?
Yeah, combination of alleys closing and, you know, just people moving on to other things. For example, like my sister, who is, I have argued she is one of the top three bowlers to ever bowl in the state of Maine for women. She quit. She's won like three Maine state championships in a row. She was Maine Pro Bowler of the Year, and she just got, I don't like this anymore. I've got nothing else to prove. I'm done.
And she has a 199 streak, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was there. I kept score for that one. That was during league in Lisbon Falls, a small 8-lane house. She threw a spare in the 10th. She had a chance. Missed the head pin. Ended up with a 7 break. I mean, so for 199. But, she had it. She had the chance.
I always argue, is it worse to throw the 199 or to have, I don't know. Like, I had 194 and a fill at a TV roll off, and I punched 2, and I was so angry. But I don't know if I ended up throwing a 5 and throwing 199, would I be angry? Like, would it be worse?
No, you'll be angry. And I'll tell you why. I was in a pro tour and I had 197 in a ball, and I punched the 1.5.
Well, at least
for 199.
That's what something Jeremy tried to teach me. If you hit the head pin, at least you did your job. You can't.
I was mad, but I was happy because I threw a 199. Like it was really like, it was like conflicting emotions. I like wanted to punch something, but then I wanted to be all really happy. So
now, had you already had a 200 at that time, or was that?
No, I had.
Do you think you would have felt different if you hadn't had the 200 before?
Oh my God, I would have been so pissed.
Because
without a doubt.
That's the closest he's been to a 200, not to throw a dig at you. But speaking of throwing digs, Tim, have you ever thrown a 700?
This year? the answer to that is yes. I have thrown a few.
That's a few more than you, Jeremy.
Yeah. I stopped counting it. I don't know.
He stopped counting.
Dave Chesterkov said on our podcast, once you throw so many, you just lose count.
You do. You do. Honestly, the only thing, it's really, I don't know. It's not funny, but, and it's not ironic. It's just kind of humorous, is I never thought about high scores really hadn't thought about it until I read Craig Holbrook's post the other day when he was outlining his 1,400s and everything else. And I read his whole long diatribe about how he came up with that number. And I started thinking about like the high scores and things like that. And I realized at that point that I had 17 scores that were 190 or above, single string, that were 190 above. I have 12 190s and I have 5 200s. And I tell you right now, at 50 years old, I would be so excited to have another big string. They are so fleeting that you got to stop and embrace the moment. And I didn't think of that until I read what Craig wrote.
Yeah.
And, you know, I will tell anyone, these young bowlers, you know, embrace the moment.
Well, it's funny because we had Steve Reno on the podcast and he came in with like a box of all stats he had kept and everything else. And it's cool to see. And he was the one that told us, because we have a house high that we have listed at 194. And he immediately said, that's not right. Tommy also threw 200 in your house. And he knew the date, the tournament it was in, like he had it all.
That's cool. That, you know, I mean, I wished I'd have kept far better track of my scores.
Yeah.
Over the last 30 years. And I told Brian and I had this conversation, Brian Athern and I, when we were driving down to Exeter. This was back in, I don't know, October, November, whatever. It was back in the fall. And we were talking about it. And I was like, how cool would it be to go back and have every string that you've ever thrown boxed, like boxes. So you knew.
You'd be Mark Gregory.
I know. And that's what got us talking about it. And I was like, at first I was like, oh God, then I got thinking about it. Being, oh my God, that would be so cool. I'm a numbers guy, not, you know, Bob Lee numbers guy, but I like numbers and stats and things like that, because numbers and stats don't lie.
Right.
Right.
You know, and to be able to go back and like say, hey, I had out of 150 strings this year, whatever it was, I had X amount of strikes, X amount of spares, X amount of tens, you know, things like that. I don't know. I'm a geek like that. I think it'd be so cool to be able to go back and look at that.
Now, I know it hasn't really taken off in Maine at this point. I know like Paul Grant wants to go up there, I think for, to film in Amanda Carroll league. There's more stuff like the Freshies Nico, the ACST, where people are doing a lot more streaming. Do you think that's good for the game as far as, because we don't have like the Channel 5 days and stuff like that. Would you like to see more streaming as far as matches go? I know Exeter has the TV lanes now.
Oh my God. Absolutely. Yes.
You can 100%. Save some of that stuff.
I would love it. So I'm one of the, Jeremy and I had this little bit of a conversation that we're lucky enough that we've been able to experience bowling on TV.
Yeah.
And bowling under the lights, and the difference that it is bowling with the lights. And so he and I had that conversation, and then Amanda Carroll and I had it because she had never bowled on TV. And so I was trying to explain to her what it was like, that it's still 60 feet. It's still an approach. It's that nothing changes other than the lights. It's brighter. It's warmer.
Yeah.
You're solo, like you're alone up there. I don't know. Yes, I am a huge proponent of streaming. I wish more bowling alleys would, you know, honestly would invest a little bit in their Wi-Fi or even get Wi-Fi. Because I think they're missing the boat on what it can do to their game, to their house, and to the game in general.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's funny. It's like now it's almost like there's more content available now than there ever has been.
We just had a big match today, Winchell against Daly, 615 to 594. Like that.
I was. So I work from home when I'm not. So how do I word this? I'm an on the road salesman. Okay. But I work from my home office. So I was home this afternoon and I saw it and I put it on and I worked. So I have two screens. Yeah. I had it going on one screen and I'm working on the other. So I was able to, I mean, that to me, that's the future of our game.
I agree.
It's not Nesson.
Sean. I forget what he threw. Yeah, Sean against Riccitelli earlier today as well. Like, it's cool. You know, obviously everyone has different schedules. I know Rob Linehan and Sean were bowling, and somebody commented, you know, is this live? Who has time to bowl at noon? But they both don't have 9 to 5s. They work different shifts. And right. To be at work and then all of a sudden see a match pop up is kind of cool. It's almost like March Madness where you can kind of peek in real quick. And
absolutely. Absolutely. I would, you know, and the really cool part of, you know, what Bob and, you know, what Paul are doing is this is forever.
Yeah.
This is on YouTube. These are matches you can go back and watch. And I actually have done it a few times as I've gone back to some of my older stuff that was on tape or something and been able to see things that I was doing. And yeah. Be like, oh shit, that's what I'm a huge proponent of video.
Yeah.
Why do you think JD Martinez goes back and watches video of his at bat every single time?
What I think is cool too is like I've had a couple of matches where afterwards, you know, especially if I didn't bowl well, which is typical, and I'll get a message from somebody who'll say like, hey, I noticed you're dipping your shoulder a lot. Have you thought about? It was actually Chris Winiar. As I said, I've been dipping my shoulder since I've been bowling. I said I'll never get over it. He said if your chin stays up, you can't dip your shoulder. So it's something I've been working on.
Yeah,
and I've never bowled with Chris, but he happened to see it on tape.
So here's my take on that. Number one, I love it. I love the fact that we have other bowlers reaching out to help other bowlers.
Yeah.
That to me is cool. Number two is I may, like, Jeremy, if I'm not mistaken, you and I had this conversation at Lita a couple weeks ago. And I want to say it was either the fourth string. I think you were on 19 and I was on 20.
Yeah, we were at the opposite ends.
Well, we weren't on opposite ends at that point because you were on 19 and I was on 20,
which is right next to each other. So it was a fifth string.
Yeah, fifth string. And I think I had noticed something that you were doing that you weren't early. I forgot what it was now. I wish I could. It was like a little tweak. And I take full credit for you making the, you know, make it not the 400 that you threw the first three. It was a little tweak I did. I think, Danny, that is something that's cool that, again, someone's not trying to change your bowling.
Right.
But they're just giving you a little tweak. And if that little tweak adds a couple of pins of string.
Yeah.
Well, then you can focus on something else at that point.
I think that was one of my issues too, is every time I wasn't bowling well, it was, you know, do a complete tear down and try to rebuild instead of now it's like trying to fix one thing at a time.
Yeah.
Which I noticed has helped a lot. So going back a little bit, you said, you know, you were a pacer bowling in these tournaments. What types of tournaments did you start getting into when you took that step from, you know, kids league bowler to working with Ross? Now you're bowling in tournaments.
Sure. I went straight from kids leagues to the main state tournaments, adult tournaments. I think I was 18 or 19. And then I joined the main pro tour in 90-91 season, I think it was. And my first pro tour event was in Old Town, Maine. The only thing I can remember, there's two things I remember from that day was I'm warming up and some strange gentleman came up behind me and whispered in my ear that my ass looked pretty good in those jeans and turned around and walked away. I'm 18, 19 years old. I walked over to my mother and I said, what the hell just happened? And I told her and she laughed because that was Chip. It was Chip Carson.
Okay.
So Chip was just trying to get in my head. He was a, knew what he was, you know, he knew who I was just from my mother.
Right.
You know, it was funny to me. It's still funny 30 years later. But I started out with an 86 string, and then went 186, and then went 89.
So you pulled a him.
Yeah.
I went 360 something with a 186 string. That's
my high single. my high single was at an Outrun the Bear. I threw a 175. I had Brian Heffernan come over and say, you know, why don't you bowl in Pro Series stuff? I said, I can't string them together. He said, you throw a ball like that, you could bowl in anything. And I followed it up with an 81 and got eliminated. He walked by me and went, that's why I don't bowl in Pro Series events. So, been there.
Yeah, you know, it's just, I don't know. I'll never forget it. I couldn't tell you what my total was that day.
Yeah.
I still, to this day, don't remember what it was. I just remember the first three strings because of it was such a roller coaster of, oh my God, I just threw an 86 string to, oh my God, I just threw a 186, which at the time was my high string. And then, oh my God, I threw an 89. Like, what the hell just happened? Like, instead of being, hey, not bad, I just won 120 something average for three strings. No, it was,
It's always how you finish.
Yeah.
So I remember my first WCBC tour, I was paired with Carrington and I was scared shitless.
I would terrified. Be too.
I was absolutely terrified.
I'd still be terrified. I'm 50 years old and I've bowled with him in many tournaments. I'd still be terrified.
he was really nice to me. Probably, I don't know. I probably looked like scared. he was really good.
Patted Jeremy on the head and said, it'll be okay.
All right, little boy, you'll be okay.
How long was it before you got invited to Worlds?
1992 was my first Worlds.
So not long at all.
No, what happened was, I still remember it vividly, was I was at a friend's house playing cards 2 weeks before the Worlds, and I get a phone call at my friend's house, and it's Charlie Milan.
It's a good phone call.
And I get a phone call. Tim, you got a call. What? I'm at a friend's house. Pick it up. It's Charlie. He goes, you're bowling in 2 weeks. Excuse me? Charlie, I got a job. No, take it off. Take the week off. I'm putting a team in. You're bowling in 2 weeks.
Oh,
like he didn't give me the opportunity to say no. He was like, I need a team. You're bowling. You know, I think I had to sell like 10 tickets. Like that was it, like $100. And I borrowed $100. My mom's boyfriend at the time gave me $100 so I could bowl in the singles. Like I wasn't going to bowl. I was just going to go up and watch. And he handed me $100 and said, no, you're going to go bowl. I'm like, oh, okay. And my first string I threw was a 96 and said, yeah, that's a nice waste of $100. And then I started the next string with a triple strike. And ended up bowling 667.
Oh, wow.
And qualified 31st.
Did they take 32?
Huh?
Did they take 32?
Oh. Yeah. 666 was a cutoff.
Oh, my God. That's insane.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is I made it, like, I made it all the way to the final four.
What house was this at? Do you remember?
Bangor.
Okay.
Yeah. And I, there was a video, there's actually a video, Steve Reno posted a while back of the 92 Worlds. And there's a shot of me and I'm looking, I think I weighed like 130 pounds. Like
that's what I weighed in fifth grade.
I'm like, oh my God. But I ended up bowling, I bowled the final four, Jeff Atkins, and I threw a double in the fourth and fifth and got all excited because I'm beating Jeff Atkins. And I was on the left. He was on the right. And, of course, back then, there was no ball-for-ball box for box shit. I mean, no one did that. So I was ready to go, so I threw. I cut it. I didn't cut him off. I went first on the left, thinking that if I could just throw the triple in his face. And I left a cluster of five, the diamond plus one on the left. And he proceeded to go 5 out of 5 in the back half. And I took my $750 and said, thank you very much.
we had this conversation actually after we stopped recording, which I kind of wish we caught it. You asked my opinion on going ball for ball, box for box.
Yes.
And I'm the proponent of as long as I don't cut anybody off or as nobody cuts me off, I don't care when you ball. I really don't. Yep.
So great topic. I'm with Jeremy. I could care less what the bowler next to me is doing. I don't care. Like if we're not on the same box, I don't care. If I'm done before you, cool. If you're done before me, that's okay. I still got to throw my ball. Like it's, I, the only time I really go ball for ball now is the Worlds.
Yeah.
And that changed because it never used to be that way. When I started, the first 6-7 years until the late 90s, there was never ball for ball. Like,
I forget what thread started this, but did you see the one on Facebook where somebody said, I wish I could remember what it was, but they said, I'm old school. I do box for box. And I commented, actually, that's not old school. That's more of a newer thing. And the only reason I know, because I've only been bowling for about 8 or 9 years, I think, was I took the bowling instructor class with Dan Murphy. Yep. And we were talking about leagues and things like that. And he brought up the fact that he said we had 5-man leagues. 5 nights or 7 nights a week. I don't remember if it was 5 or 7, but he said we had a 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and a 9 o'clock shift. If you did this whole box for box thing, we'd never get these leagues done. He's like, you bowl when you're ready to bowl, you throw them. I go, I'm not getting a mark and then waiting for you, and then you get a mark and then you're waiting for me. Just bowl.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Brian and I have had this argument. He gets right, almost offended when I'm like, he's like, well, that's bothering me that you're so far ahead of me. And I
throw more marks.
Well, it's bothering me that I got to wait for you. So you want me to alter mine because you're like, so my comment to him, and he laughs, is bowl better. Like,
so at Exeter, you don't go box for box?
What, in the pro league?
Yeah.
No, they do. They do.
Well, I know. I just didn't know if you personally just bowled or if you went box.
No, I follow along with what everyone else is doing.
I think for leagues, it's pretty good, especially if you don't have a league right after you. But I don't do it for tournaments. Like if it's not head to head and it's just like the field, I don't worry about what other. Yeah, at that point, you're just bowling.
In a tournament, singles, doubles, whatever it is. No, I'm bowling for me. Like,
yeah,
exactly. Especially, I mean, if you're working out, like when I was bowling next to Woodside, if I'm railing off 3-4 marks in a row, he's shooting. Like if he misses his spare, my pins are set. I mean, unless he's ready to go. I mean, I may let him finish his box, but if he's waiting for a shot, I'm just going to go. Like, yeah. I want to keep the momentum going.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, when you say old school, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Right.
It wasn't when you're ready, as long as you weren't cutting someone off.
And I remember Dan Murphy's other theory too was if you're bowling somebody of an equal caliber, you're probably going to end up with roughly the same amount of spares and strikes, but you're not going to throw them in the same boxes.
Right.
So you should get pretty close to being where you want to be at the end anyways.
Right.
So of course somebody throws a 4-bagger, you're not going to, it's not always going to be the case, but.
Well, yeah, you know, but you, I've always said there's no defense in bowling.
Right.
The only defense is bowling is having a pretty damn good offense, and that's it. So, you know, if I throw a triple at someone and I throw a strike, I press a button, I throw another strike and they're still in the first box, you know? Sorry, you know?
Now, have you been on a world championship team?
Yes.
Yeah. Who was that? Main Heat, or was that a different team?
Main Heat in 2001.
Who was on that team?
That was Charlie Milan, Russ Neely, James Milan, Sean Morrison, and myself. Jerry Scott was our sixth bowler. Jerry came to us on Friday morning and said he was done. He was too nervous to bowl anymore. So we had a 60-plus-year-old, a 60-year-old, James... You know, Morrison was 19 or 20 at the time, and myself, I was 30. And away we went. You know, it just we clicked at the right time and had a great playoff run. So
was that against McLaughlin?
Yeah, that was. So the first match. So Morrison and I both went 3 400s out of four matches. Morrison was averaged 142, 143, somewhere around there for the playoffs. And I was like 138, 137.
He was insane around that time. I remember that.
That was his, call to coming out party was the Worlds. He won the singles and then we won the team event. And then he had a stretch where he was pretty dominant. No doubt about it.
Yeah. My first year at the Worlds was 03. And I think he won the singles that year. I want to say he beat, I don't know if it was Sargent. I don't remember who he beat, but I remember he qualified 7-something. And then his strings leading up to, like, he went 1400 for 10, for basically 10 strings. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, no, that was a good run. And that, the year that we won in 2001 was, you know, Nate was supposed to have bowled with us, but he went golfing down in Carolinas instead. So it left us with 6 bowlers for the week. And again, kudos to Charlie and Russ. That was their first Worlds tournament that they won. So it was pretty special.
Do you feel like, I've had this debate before about teams way back when going with 5 guys or 6 guys, do you think that puts a lot of pressure on you to make sure, you know, you got to stay healthy for a lot of games?
So I don't remember when it started with, you know, going from 5 guys to 6 guys to 7 guys. And I've even been on teams with as much as 10 guys, which
I was going to ask you about that as well. Cause that was recent, right?
Well, the 10 guys was, I've done it a couple of times over the past 8 to 10 years. You know, I understand going with 10 guys. If you've got a guy that can only be there Tuesday and Wednesday, and you've got a guy that can't be there until Thursday, and right. You know, you're kind of piecing it together. It's really difficult to go with 10 guys starting on, you know, Tuesday morning. You really have to have people that understand their roles, and right. You know, your 8th, 9th, and 10th bowler need to understand that. Okay, your 8th bowler may see the lane every once in a while. Your 9th and 10th bowler, guys, you're, you know, keep score, cheer, and if we need you, like, be ready. But don't expect to bowl. You know, this isn't, how do I word this? So this isn't.
You don't all get equal playing time.
It's not equal playing time. You know, so I'm a proponent of limiting it to 8 people.
I think 8's a good number.
Yeah.
It's like 7, like 7's good. You have your 5 core and then you have, you know, your 2 bench guys, but you know, somebody could get hurt.
Yeah.
You know, I always think about the teams that had 5, you tear a bicep that second game and you're done. Like,
oh yeah. I personally like 8 as the number, with the 8th bowler understanding that, you know, they may not bowl.
Right.
They may not. I've always liked that number. You know, I've done 6. That sucks. I bowled every string the first 5 years that I bowled in the Worlds. I bowled every single string. 33 strings a week.
Yeah, I don't want to do that.
You know, I can't. Like, I physically can't do it anymore. Yeah, it's the Worlds is it's just a different beast. It's such a fun tournament, and but it's such a long tournament. So
I know it wasn't Worlds; it was internationals, whatever, they invitationals. You were on the team with Price Wood that won the whole thing last year, correct?
Yes.
And yep. So that was a 10-person team. Nate was, you know,
we didn't have 10.
Oh, I thought you did have 10. So I remember Nate saying that he felt that you could never have enough talent. You didn't have 10.
We have 10. Shit, I don't know how many people we had. Now, I thought it was 8 or 9, but maybe it was, I don't know.
What was it like? You went from being, you know, you said the 30-year-old, you had Charlie on your team, you had Russ on your team, who obviously sounds like he brought you up. What was it like kind of transitioning to that other role of you were more the mentor on that team? Nate was, you know, still a younger coach. You know, you have Daly on that team that, you know, a young kid. What's it like kind of playing a different role where you're no longer, the you know, you're the veteran now on the team?
I get it. I really like it.
Yeah.
I do. As I've gotten older, I really love the fact that I'm the, you know, I'm the old man. They call me Gramps on the team. Like, that's, you know, that's the running joke on the team. Everyone on our team, I am old enough to be their father. Except for, well, I don't know how old Nate is. Nate's what, 34, 35?
Yeah, he's a few years younger than me.
So that'd be borderline, but I mean, it's just, it's funny to me that everyone on that team, but you know, I can still bowl and I can still compete. And you know, every once in a while, I kind of got to show it to them that, you know, the arm still has it, you know, the old man still has it. You know, the old man, you know, 1994 Tim shows up every once in a while.
You told me the other day, or at Lita, you actually throw the ball harder now.
I do, which is really weird.
That makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I'm throwing it 5 or 6 mile per hour faster, but I'm 1 to 2 mile per hour faster now than I was, because I feel I have to be to break the pins up more. How do I word this? We all know that proprietors these days do not take care of the plates the way they used to back 20 years ago.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, I work in the center, and I'll tell you, I agree with that.
Right. Now, I'm not saying that 20 years ago they juiced up the plates. That's not what I mean by that.
Of course. Okay.
What I mean is back then, like Russ used to do the plates Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. He did them 3 times a week. Cesar Mendez did them every single day up in Pittsfield.
How many?
It was never Pittsfield, Maine.
Right, but how many lanes did they have?
Pittsfield had 20, 18,
that 16, horrible.
16 yeah. to 20.
Do you do that every single day?
He called it his 15 minutes of love.
15, took him 15 minutes?
That's what he said.
Oh my God, when they had me doing plates at Fairway, I mean, they had like literally scrubbed every inch of the deck, and then you give it a little bit of spray down, not a lot, you know, I put it on a rag and just wipe it in. 32 lanes. I mean, that sucked. I can't imagine doing that every day.
So Stars and Strikes now was Oxford Hills, has 14 lanes. It would take me, if I did the plates, you know, you go down, you knock all the pins off, you wipe it off. We use a spray bottle and you'd do, I don't know, 3 or 4 squirts.
Yeah.
And then you'd wipe it in and got to use a circular motion. And I'll tell you that actually makes side to side, back to front sucks because the pins will go like that. But if you do circular, it just covers better. But they don't do that now like they did back then. And back then they were using lane conditioner because number one, it was a hell of a lot cheaper.
Right.
Okay. So it made things a little dirtier and people would complain, well, my hands are dirty. Oh, it's bowling. Like you're sweating and your hands are going to get dirty.
But I can't eat my nachos if my hands are dirty.
Eat with your left hand. It's so what I have found is I've gotten a little older because people are using different things for the plates. I find that I have to throw it just a touch harder to get things to break up more. Mm-hmm. The problem is I've become less accurate because I'm trying to break things up more. So, yeah, it's crazy.
Now, going back to what you said about, you know, bowling in the Maine state tournaments and everything, I do remember one of your podcasts on Ripping the Rack talking about the state of Maine bowling and how it's not, I think you're the line I remember you saying was you lost money to win a tournament.
the last, it might have been the teams event that we won. By the time I found in the gas money, the lunch, my bowling, I did not make what I spent to enter the tournament and pay for that. I think I won like $85, and it was $65 to enter, and it was another $20+ in gas, and it was another $15 to $20 in food, you know, to eat. So I literally won a state title and lost money. So I don't bowl the states anymore.
What do you think can be done that could bring the game kind of back? I know one of the big answers people have is like youth leagues. Have you ever thought about getting involved in coaching like youth leagues and things like that?
Yes and no. When my kids were younger, none of them bowled. None of them had any interest in bowling. So we were always at basketball tournaments. We were always at some type of sporting event on weekends. So I never got a chance to do it. Now my kids are all grown and out of the house. And now, you know, my wife and I use weekends for our time. Right. So it's really difficult to make the time.
Yeah.
Because there's only so much time in a week. There's only time in a day.
Right.
And, you know, not working in a bowling alley, not having kids that are in the leagues, it's really difficult to find that time. There are a couple of youth kids that bowl out of Oakland Park, Jason Kaler's place. One of them is a friend of mine's daughter. She's 10 years old, and she bowls in some of the leagues because there is no kids league. There is no youth league anymore.
Yeah.
So I've worked with her a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, just trying to get her to, she's really good bowler. She's like 100 average already at like 10 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun to watch her bowl. She's going to, if she stays with it, she's going to be really good.
Yeah. That's what we need too.
It is.
Cause I don't know what youth leagues you have around you, but I can tell you. So my wife, Kate, and I run the kids league here, and we've been doing it for about 7 or 8 years, but we had Steve Reno came in last week, and we were like, oh, this guy bowled on Channel 5. You would have thought the kids saw Santa Claus. Like, they were so excited to like a pro bowler came. And you know what annoyed me was a lot of stuff he told him. I was telling him for 8 years, but what do I know? So, but to have somebody with that type of resume, and you have a great resume yourself, I'm not saying to do it every week, but I wonder if you have a kids league near you, like that might kind of, you don't know what that kid might take away.
Which is true. And the closest kids league that I know of is about 30 miles away.
Yeah, it's tough.
so it's really tough.
Yeah. You almost have another reason to be out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't, that's heading north. And honestly, when I leave this house, 9 times out of 10, it's going south.
Right.
Just because in Augusta, which would be the next closest, is an hour from me. So yeah. for me to be at a kids league in Augusta, unfortunately, it's not realistic.
Well, especially how you said at Oakland Park, they don't have a kids league either.
Right. Yeah.
So obviously you and Brian have the Rip and the Rag podcast. How did that start? Like what gave you guys the idea?
So about a year before we actually started, we were in league one night and I looked at him and I said, let's do a podcast.
Sounds like our story.
And he was like, yeah, what do you want to talk about? And I said, yes. You know, like I like to talk, and people know that about me. I'm a talker. I just, whatever you want to talk about, I'll find something to contribute to that, whether or not it's good, I don't know. But it literally started out as, let's do a podcast. Okay. What do you want to talk about? Let's talk about sports. All right. Well, what about sports? You know what? Let's do one about bowling. And then let's do another one about sports. You know what? Let's do a podcast that combines it all.
Right.
So we went back and forth, and finally, you know, we just said, screw it. You know, during the pandemic, let's just start doing it. So it started, and it started out as like an hour and a half long podcast, 2 hour long podcast, where we talked bowling for the first half, and then we were talking whatever else for the second half. And then it was, well, let's do a bowling podcast, then a whatever pod. I mean,
you guys were up to 2 shows a week.
We were, and it became way too much. So we got rid of the second show, which honestly I miss, because that's the one where we can talk about anything.
Yeah.
And now we've talked bowling so much that I can only regurgitate so many of the stories that I have, or anecdotes or whatever. Yeah. So like this week we talked a little bit of bowling, and then we talked Adam Sandler movies and a couple other things. And, you know, we're going to do that probably through the summer. Just
not much going on.
Yeah. So we'll probably do that. And then next fall, we'll pick back up talking about bowling again and, you know, highlighting some of the bigger tournaments and, you know, some of the stuff like that.
And then how did you end up adding Calvin and then later Mark onto the show as well?
Yeah. So, you know, Brian and I got talking and we're like, you know, it's just you and I, and we're from Maine. So we actually, and I don't remember if we got Marky first or if we got,
I think it was Mark. Cause I joke with him. I'm like, yeah, I said, Richie was a guest on the show and then he never left.
Yeah. And that's honestly what it was, we had him as a guest. And then I was like, well, wait, he's a proprietor. He's in Massachusetts. Yeah. He knows bowlers down there. So let's add him to the show. And then we were like, well, shit, we got everything down here. We need a Canadian representative. And who doesn't like to hear their own voice more than Calvin?
I thought it was good, too, because I remember you guys going over the Mixed Worlds roster. And there were some teams from Mass that you weren't, especially newer teams that you weren't familiar with. But Mark knew who those guys, you know, that like the team Adam Millis. He knew who all those bowlers were. And yeah, you know, I'm sure you knew a lot of the main bowlers that he may not know. So it is a good mix to have a little bit of everybody to get that aspect of it.
It is. And, you know, unfortunately, Mark, you know, the only time we can tape is really Monday evenings. And Mark's got the bowling alley, right, and he's been busy. So he hasn't joined the last three or four of them. And I don't know if he'll be back. You know, unfortunately, it's not that we want him gone. It's not that he wants to be gone. It's just he needs to make money and feed his family.
Well, I can tell you, just, we've had some really good numbers here at our location as far as just bowling numbers. I've talked to Lexi over at Lita. She said they've had some of the best weeks. I've seen Bolarama posted that they weren't even answering the phone last week because it was so busy. Matt Nichols says Timber's been cranking. So I think, and I don't know about Riverwalk, but it just sounds like a lot more alleys are getting more. So it's almost like people are making up for all that lost time, and not just the league bowlers, just open bowling.
And I hope so, because, you know, bowling, I hate to say bowling's a dying sport because it really draws a negative to the game.
Right. I don't necessarily agree with
it's, that. It's not that it's dying. That's it's transitioning.
Yes.
Okay. And it's the more that we can do, there's more tournaments to bowl in now than there were back in the day, back in what I would call the heyday. Mm-hmm. There's more options. Now, on one hand, that's good. But on the other hand, it's kind of bad because, like, there's a really good tournament that I'm bowling in on Saturday, April 16th and at Stars and Strikes that they've had for years. It's a handicapped team event. But Easter Classic's the very next day. So some folks that had bowled in this in the past are now not, you know. So what I don't want to see happen is saturation of tournaments. Right.
And I think Lexi's calendar is very important for that. And I think people need to do a better job. Nobody in particular, but making sure, you know, and I've seen the post before, you know, hey, looking to do a tournament in August. Does anybody have any dates already booked?
Yeah.
I think people need to start making sure that they're not stepping on toes as far as that goes, because like you said, if you have four really good tournaments all on the same day, there's only so many bowlers.
Right. Right. And there's only so many, you know, look, let's face it. When I bowl a tournament, I don't necessarily bowl handicap tournaments.
Right.
And it's not for not wanting to. It's just that those aren't designed for any bowler that's a 118, 120 average higher.
Right. For me, like if we're doing, and you can put a ding on this and out on the bear. If I know like there's a like the Exeter League, if we're doing a handicap one, I may run it at the same time as the Exeter League because it's handicap and I'm not probably going to get that necessarily group of people. But if I'm doing a scratch, I'll avoid any pro series weekend, any pro league. Yeah. I'll avoid all that stuff because those are the guys that I want for that tournament specifically.
Yeah. And what we need is with these sort of like your Outrun the Bear scratch, I couldn't make it to the last one, but you had close to 70 people.
I think, yeah, we had about 70.
It was somewhere in the high 60s to around 70.
And sponsorships help huge with that.
And that's what I'm talking about. You want to get people in, you got to get the money there. I mean, $2,000 to win a tournament's good money.
Right.
And that's going to bring, that's going to bring people in.
Yeah.
And the way you have it set up where you don't necessarily have to have the highest score to move on, that brings in your, what I would call your mid-level, mid-tier bowlers that are either A, they're moving, they're trying to move up.
Yeah.
Or B, they're maybe they're like me and they're on there starting a decline, but they can still compete. And, you know, they know that they don't, the only time they have to have the best score is if they make it to the final.
Right.
Right. You know, and if they have a deep run and then they just miss making a cut to go to, like, say, the eighth round, it's like, oh, I was just there. You know what? I could do that again.
I think the year Rob Linehan won, he never broke 130, but he stayed in this pocket of like 126 to like 112. Yep. He like just stayed and it just cruised through the tournament.
It did the Phil Clough.
Yeah. And Phil Clough did the same thing.
But that's, but see, it's those types of tournaments that are going to draw your 70 plus bowlers.
Yeah.
If you just ran a 10 string tournament, said, hey, it's $2,000 to the winner. Here's two shifts, whatever. You might get 50 guys.
Right.
You might get a little more.
Spare time. Jeremy was in a tournament. He said, Jeff Surrett's in first place. I said, how close are you? He said, if he goes home now, I need a 119 to catch him.
Yeah. Yeah. It just, I mean, look, Jeremy's been there. I've been there. You know, I've been the guy that walks in and just looks around and people are like, oh shit, Tim's bowling. Yeah. You know, those days are long gone. Oh, I shouldn't say long gone. Those days are pretty much gone. But if you had that outrun the bear where you get those 70 guys and the next thing you know is like, okay, well, crap, I just had it. Oh, I made it. I blew 118.
Well, Aaron Fontaine called Tom, his grandpa, Jaju, and said, I got eliminated. Come to find out he made the cut by one pin. Ends up winning the whole tournament.
Yeah. But that's what the game needs, in my eyes. This is, again, I am by no means the word of whatever of candlepin bowling. I just, I've seen a lot.
Yeah. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You have a 200 single, 500 triple, and an 805. Is that correct?
Yes.
How many other people do you know of have that?
Chris Sargent does.
Sargent has an 800. Chris has an 800.
Chris Sargent.
I know Mike Sargent does.
I'm pretty sure Chris has several of them. I know of at least one that he. I know of at least one that he has up in Newport, Maine, where he was.
I know Mike Sargent went 841, which is just stupid in my mind.
Yeah, Chris. I know has at least three or four of them that I know of.
Insanity.
Yeah. Threat.
See, Mike.
Does he have a 500?
Yeah. So
Jeff has a 500, right?
Yeah. So Jeff and Mike Sargent were the only other two that I knew of.
Oh, Chris Sargent, I know does.
I didn't know yeah. Chris had an 800.
I know AJ Aljoy has a five. I know he has a 800. And he has several, I think he's got almost a dozen 200s. But I don't think he has a 500. Charlie Milan, I don't think has a 500. I think has an 800.
Those are just crazy numbers. I want to kind of get through a bunch of the Facebook questions people asked. Mike McGinty had asked the question, not yourself personally, what's the best clutch shot you've ever seen?
I saw that earlier. Oh my God. I saw that earlier. And there's a couple that come to mind. One is, and I hate to bring this up, but Chip Carson spare in the 10th of the 2000 World's Finals of the 30th box. He made a tremendous shot. Unfortunately, we won't talk about the fill. Half Worcester left and lose by one. But the spare he made, I still have PTSD about Dave Godwin in the 2019 international, not international, the Mixed Worlds.
I was at that.
Oh, were you?
I wasn't bowling. So Kate was on Heffernan's team that year. So I was a bowling wife.
Yeah. Were you there for the final match?
But I was, when we were driving, somebody put it on Facebook Live.
So I was watching it.
It's I have PTSD about that one. I love Dave. Dave is a good friend of mine. I have a absolutely amazing amount of respect for Dave. The ability to go, to be down 17 with two boxes to go for 10 grand and go spare, makes a great spare in the ninth and throws an absolute missile of a strike in the 10th. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's one of the most clutch bowling I've ever seen.
We pulled off into a gas station to watch the last few boxes of that match.
I know that I was part of that losing team, but that will always go down as one of my favorite matches of all time. It was 192 degrees in there. It was hot. There was a ton of people. Oh my God.
A lot of people in that building.
You know, but there was a ton of people. It was intense. The match never was more than, 20 on either side. And
that match only happened because there was a tie on wins, right?
Yeah, we won our last string, and they lost their last string.
Yeah, so that.
And yeah, we had to go undefeated on Sunday, and we went undefeated on Sunday to force a one string playoff.
Oh, the last box.
Last box. Just
two people had asked this question, and I know you keep saying your best days are behind you. I don't know if I buy it, but we'll go with that. What is something you have yet to accomplish that you would like to accomplish in your bowling career?
Okay. I know people are expecting me to say nothing because
I've accomplished everything.
I've accomplished everything. On one hand, I have won or accomplished everything I have set out to win. I would like to win. I think it'd be really cool to win the world singles. I've made it to the final four a couple of times, never won. So I would probably say the world singles would be pretty cool, but I don't bowl it all the time either. There are sometimes I just don't bowl. And I'm getting, again, I'm not old, but I am getting to that point where winning the tournament is more important to me than winning the singles.
Matt Nichols wants to know, how good of a lane would Route 1 make? It looked like it was a little...
Yeah, Route 1, it really depends. If you're throwing it down the middle, if you're right on the yellow line and you can straddle the yellow line, it would make a really good lane. Other than that, if you're on the left side, it really pulls to the left. So you've got to play the break. And if you're on the right side, it really pulls to the right.
How sure were you, for people who are listening, he threw a ball down Route 1. How sure were you that a car wasn't going to come down?
Well, it was nighttime and I could see the lights.
Okay. They're not going slow.
I did see lights in the distance. So I didn't throw it really hard. So it just keeps going.
Yeah.
And I did kind of hook it a little bit so it would go into the ditch because I really didn't want that bouncing down Route 1 with a car coming and be like,
So how'd you kill somebody?
So how'd someone die?
Yeah.
So it would, it would probably not be a really, I wouldn't recommend it.
So you'd have the same look on your face that Baker had when he threw that 58
foot ball. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I asked him, I'm like, what happened? And he's like, I saw it going. I'm like, oh no, get down.
And then the last question for me, and ironically, the people from Spread Eagle Productions both asked the same question. Bob had a little bit of a longer one. Unfortunately, I don't think we have time for that. You guys do the power rankings, which I think is a great idea. There's a good amount of bowlers out there, and we're not all bowling in the same things. How do you guys come up with those to decide who's your top 10 for the current week or however often you guys are?
So I'm going to say this on, and I've gone on record on the other show, and I'll say it here. We are no longer doing the rankings.
No?
No. Too many people took it way too serious. I got way too many messages going, how can you not have me up in the top five? This is what I've done. And I'm like, whoa, relax here, sailor. Like, I just, they, people, t- it was supposed, met, it was supposed to be in fun.
Have they met Nugent?
You know, it was supposed to be in fun.
Yeah. And, I thought it was great.
You know, I enjoyed it, but ultimately, and I saw the questions and really, the only fair way to do a ranking system is to develop a handicap, a gin, basically like you have for golf. And that's where you take in your, you know, your slope rating for the house you're in.
Right.
And your score, and next thing you know, putting your top 10 scores in, and that's the only way you're
going to get a ranking. About database like that. I do actually have one more. I'm sorry.
Sure, no, that's okay.
We're gonna go with a 5-man team. We're not gonna have a bench. Steve Marino asked this question. Your world's team, past or present, 5 guys. You can be on it or not. It's up to you.
I probably wouldn't. Now, can okay?
It's the bowler in their prime.
I'm gonna go Charlie Mylan, Craig Holbrook, Jeff Surratt, Chris Hollett. Can I mix Canadian American?
Yeah, that's fine.
And Robbie Henderson.
It's a good team.
Those were two guys. So the first time we bowled McLaughlin, those were two guys that absolutely blew my mind. Chris Hollett and Robbie Henderson.
Yep. Yep. There was a question on, I think Jerry Dunn asked about who throws the hardest and most accurate.
Oh, I'm
trying to. And Hollett and Henderson are probably two of the ones that throw the hardest that were the most accurate, along with Sarge. I would put Chris Sargent in there.
See, I thought Robbie threw the ball a little bit harder than Chris Hollett.
He probably did.
We have any footage, Bob will go frames per second to find out. Anybody has anything, we'll get it down for you.
I I'm blessed to have seen amazing bowlers in their prime. You know, I got a chance to bowl against, you know, Hollett and Henderson and Peter Flynn, you know, Chris Sargent, you know, Tommy Olsta, Paul Berger, you know, Craig Holbrook. I am absolutely blessed and lucky enough to have been able to bowl against all of these guys, you know, Charlie Mylan and Russ Neely, Al Joy. I have taken or have tried to take something from just about everybody that I've seen. I'd never had the speed that like Sarge or Hollett or Henderson. I never was able to throw that hard. Russ taught me how to pick pins. Charlie really focused on the mental side of things. I've seen some really cool shit in this game. Really, I just have, to have bowled against some of them and to have beat some of them, it's pretty cool, you know.
So usually I finish up with my infamous question. Not that it's really infamous. If you had to pick one bowler that you would say is your favorite to watch, or somebody that influenced you. Who would it be?
Sure. I'm gonna answer this in two ways. Okay. I'm gonna answer prior and then current. Okay. I absolutely love to watch Russ and Charlie bowl. For a number of reasons. You know, number one is they both just took me in. I can't say anything more than that. They were absolutely, besides my mother and whatnot, they were the reason that I became good. It's the only way I can put it, is both of them helped me so much. And the fact is, I mean, I got to watch one of the most amazing performances I've ever seen when Russ Neely went 1485 in the main state elimination tournament. And this wasn't you bowl 5 boxes, you sit down. This was 10 straight strings. You bowl 5 boxes against an opponent, just swapping lanes every 5 boxes. And he had a stretch in there where he was 160, 160, 180, 160. And I have never, ever in the history of ever seen someone in a zone like that. He legit had no idea what was going on the lane next to him. And bowling with Charlie, who just, the guy epitomized winning. I mean, just funny dude. Oh my God, is Charlie's a riot. He really is so funny. So I'd say them two, and then you know, watching my sister was pretty cool. Currently, I would say probably Amanda Carroll is my favorite female bowler to watch. You know, I think you can make the case that she is arguably the best female bowler out there. Yeah. Just like you can make the case that Maddie Kelly or Jill Wood, probably those three. And you can make the case that at any one of them could be the best. You know, I'm lucky enough that I consider Amanda a friend, a really good friend, and that I've got to witness some of her bowling. And I've got to bowl with her and hopefully have more tournaments together.
She was the example that I used about streaming where I said, isn't, you know, I think it's a problem that there's more footage of me bowling out there than there is of Amanda Carroll. And I'm not saying that to be like, what, you know, people's, but she's a tremendous bowler. I'm a 1-0 bowler. Like, we need to spotlight our premier bowlers, and she's one of them.
She is the most competitive bowler, male or female, that I know that is not an ass off the lanes. Like, she is such a sweetheart and is one of the best teammates. I can't speak more highly of Amanda as a person and as a bowler. Just phenomenal. And then I love watching Surratt bowl. I always have. I've known Jeff for almost 20 years now. And the conversations that he and I have had, and I'm lucky enough that I've won with Jeff. We bowled in a couple of tournaments together that we've won. The same with Amanda, that I've won with Amanda. You know, and probably those guys right now are just, I could sit back and just watch them bowl. You know, maybe not Jeff now, because he pretty much sucks right now. I'm hoping he listens to that, because maybe that'll light a fire under his ass. But
he's supposed to come on our show too.
But I'll tell you right now, if you do not have Jeff Surratt on your Mount Rushmore of bowlers for Massachusetts, you are 100% mistaken, because he has as many titles as Tommy Olstad on the Mass Pro Tour. He's won just as much as Tommy did. Not on TV, because he didn't have the opportunity that Tommy had previously.
Yeah, he only had like the first half of his career to bowl on TV.
Right. So anyone that doesn't have Jeff up in the top three or four, I think you're wrong. Now, again, that's just my opinion. It's just totally my opinion.
He came up the year after I did, and so I've been able to basically watch his entire career, and it's been nothing short of phenomenal.
And you know what the best thing about Jeff is, though, off the lanes, he's a funny dude. Oh my God. He and I have spent more time laughing than I can count. Just, he's down to earth. He's just, his sense of humor. The problem is his sense of humor is just like mine. And as my wife will tell you, is that, you know, he's like my brother from another mother and father or whatever, but our humor is so alike that it's stupid when we put us together. And I'm sure Kristen and Angie absolutely hate it when we're together, but that's okay. You know, those, you know, Jeremy, that's a long-winded way of saying Jeff and Amanda right now. And by, yes, I also love watching Maddie bowl. If you ever want to watch a female bowler that is unreal explosive, Maddie Kelly is it.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
So we actually have to bowl.
Yeah, we have our Wednesday night league.
Nice.
So, love to have you back on again if you're ever interested.
Yes, I mean, we'll have to have the rest of you guys on and just have a full blown crossover.
I do. And look, you guys know, and I know you guys got to go bowl anytime you want me. I love talking bowling. Like, it, you know, I know people joke that they like, you know, that I like to talk about myself and bowling and things like that. And honestly, I only talk about myself when people ask questions. I don't try to bring up
questions. So,
yeah, you want to talk bowling, I'll be on anytime.
We'll get you back on. This was one of those, I'm looking at the clock going, oh no, oh no.
We just need to make sure there isn't a Leafs game on. We need Calvin's attention.
I will answer this. Because I saw he wanted to know my favorite, there's two things. My favorite bowler, where is it?
Mason Sharks, I have.
Oh, I don't want to talk Jason.
Okay.
I like Jason. So Calvin wanted to know who my favorite, Canadian bowler whose name rhymes with Melvin Sock. It's actually Delvin Spock. He's a five-pin bowler out of Flin Flon, Manitoba. And that is an actual place, Flin Flon, Manitoba. So Delvin Spock is my favorite. And what's the last one was Angela Paquette wanted to know who my favorite Canadian hockey team with the initials MC. And it's either the Mississauga Chargers or the Moose Jaw Canucks.
Did you do some research for those questions?
I did, right here. Yes. Awesome. Yeah, maybe the Merritt Centennials too, but I really like the Mississauga Chargers.
Love those answers. Now I'm bumming I didn't ask those questions. I figured they were too easy layups, but thank you so much, Tim. Really appreciate having
you. We're definitely going to have you back on.
Guys, no, that was fun. I appreciate it. You guys have a great one. I'll see Jeremy. I'll see you in like a week and a half.
I won't be at the playoffs.
That's not the playoffs. I'm not at the playoffs either.
Is it the day after the playoffs?
Exeter once a month is Sunday the 2nd.
Oh, 3rd.
Exeter once a month, whatever it is, 3rd.
Oh my God, the two of you.
All I know is it's the once every other week league. That's all I know.
Yes. Yeah. All right, guys, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Take it easy.
We'll see ya.